Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation about topics and subjects that really empower you with truthful information so you can make truly informed decisions. And as always, there's a great show in store for you today. Before we talk about the topic at hand, I just want to invite people who might be interested in a very special trip that I am facilitating. Actually, I'm more the organizer of it. And that is a trip that is going to Peru. And this program is for 2 weeks, February 13th to 26th. The program I call The Journey into the Eternal. So this is a spiritual transformational journey. If you are at a place in your life where you really are desiring to shed the old limiting beliefs, to step out of the programmings, and to really experience the greater connection to who you are, to your spiritual essence, then you might want to consider coming along with me. This is a program for women. It's for a small group of women coming from all over the world. And we are going to be specifically journeying to Peru 1 week in the Andes, spending time in Machu Picchu, and 1 week in the Amazon, spending time at an ayahuasca healing center. And this is a journey working with the plant medicines of Peru that have been used by the shaman. And by the way, we will be doing ceremonies with these plant medicines such as ayahuasca and San Pedro with the guidance of traditional shamans as part of an awakening journey. So this is a great way to begin the new year if you like to mark the new year with new beginnings. There are a couple of openings that I still have. This is only for 10 women, so there are just a few more places left. It's a very special time. This isn't about being a tourist, other than being a tourist in the sense of our own spiritual journeys. And if something like this really calls to you, I invite you to get in touch with me, and I can explain more. And the best way to do that is to email me. So you can email me directly at drselman@whatwomenmustknow.com. drselman@whatwomenmustknow.com. I'm actually really excited about this trip. I feel so strongly drawn to this experience and to the medicine of Peru, of the Amazon, because of its ancient knowledge and its ability to allow us to access greater parts of our brain, particularly the neocortex, the higher centers of who we are as humans. So pretty interesting stuff. If you're adventurous, if you're being called, definitely get in touch. Love to have you join us. Only a couple more places are available. So speaking of journeying into our greater self, recently I heard a very interesting statistic. And the statistic was that only 1% of our risk for disease and illness or our tendency for illness is related to our genes. 1%. The rest is due to the stressors that we experience on a daily level in our life. And many, many things contribute to stress in the body. And it's that stress that actually drives chronic illness and aging. So today we're going to be understanding how all forms of stress create chronic illness and aging, and more importantly, what to do about it. To help us on today's journey, I have a very special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Moss, who's going to be sharing his wisdom. I want to just add that several weeks ago now, I was on a webinar from a functional medicine forum that I belong to, and Dr. Moss was the guest, and I was really fortunate. I actually had time to tune in and listen to what he had to share, and I have to say I was so impressed with what I learned that he's here with us today, because I wanted to share his wisdom, his insights, his very profound and unique understanding with all of you. So I'm so grateful to him for making the time today. Let me just tell you a little bit about Dr. Moss. He graduated from the University of Michigan Dental School in 1974 and practiced dentistry in Grand Rapids, Michigan up until 1985. Having employed clinical nutrition in his practice for 6 years, he decided to use this experience and enter the professional supplement industry. For the past 23 years, he has operated Moss Nutrition Products, which serves healthcare professionals with nutritional supplements. Since 2000, he has served as adjunct faculty at the University of Bridgeport Nutrition Institute, starting with the vitamin and minerals class, and most recently adding the assessment and nutrition class to his teaching responsibilities. He has co-authored the textbook for nutritional medicine, and Dr. Moss was president of the International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists. So I'm really thrilled and excited to have Dr. Moss with us, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. So welcome, Dr. Moss.
Thank you, Dr. Selman. I appreciate your having me. It's great to be here.
You know, I really did love the presentation you did on that webinar, as you know, because I've talked to you about it since then, and it really did inspire me. And I know you have just a really profound understanding of making sense of the dynamics that contribute to chronic illness that really I haven't heard clearly enunciated before. So it's just great having you on the show and sharing all sorts of wonderful information with everyone. So that's what we're going to do. We're just going to jump in and, first of all, let me just ask you, having practiced as a dentist, I was just visiting my very innovative dentist today, and he was saying how the frustration he has because dentistry still separates the mouth from the rest of the body. And he was telling me, and I know this is no news to you, but I'm sure it'll be news to my listeners, that he came back from a conference recently, and they were talking about how leaky gut is one of the major drivers for periodontal disease and how important it is to really address this holistic concept of health because it's affecting our mouth as well. Do you just want to make a few comments about that?
Well, first of all, I no longer practice dentistry. Actually, I retired when I went into the supplement industry back in 85. I practiced for 10 years. Certainly have been following the dental world and the world of dental research, and things have changed. You're right, for the better. The thinking is that there is an interlink between what's going on in the mouth and the rest of the body, and I always find it interesting. Most people outside of the health professions, it's kind of like, well, that's just common sense. But as we get more educated, we become more segmented in terms of trying to divide things up into different systems, both physiologically, biochemically, anatomically. I understand why we do that. Of course, it's to try to get some type of understanding. It's complicated information. And it's hard to learn the big picture, and so when we go to school, we learn these distinct physiologic and biochemical entities. But in the end, in the process of learning, we forget to go back to the big picture, that they are all interlinked. And I certainly fell into that for many years, as most of my peers in healthcare did. And it's only in the last few years I realized that I think I missed something. It was very interesting. I was listening to your discussion about your scheduled trip to Peru. And, of course, this idea that everything is interlinked, nothing new. I mean, I'm going to be talking about fairly recent research and maybe more technical terminology, but the basic concept is nothing new. Native populations have understood this interlink of all physiologic, biochemical, and anatomic systems for, thousands of years. And they couldn't always explain it precisely in the kind of terminology that we like in our kind of left-brain medical world. They knew it. They knew it all along. So basically, this type of systems thinking, that everything is interrelated, the language may be new, it may be the words may be bigger, but it's been around for a long time.
Exactly. We're just reconnecting I think, is really a great word, reconnecting to this greater wisdom and understanding of this holistic model. And speaking of holistic models, that's what we're going to talk about today, because you are really communicating in a really clear way what is considered or what's called systems thinking. So let's explore what that means. And you're going to also be introducing a term that most people have never heard of before, which is called allostasis. And I know it's going to give my listeners such a more profound understanding of what are the real root causes that contribute to illness. So many people get a diagnosis of cancer or Alzheimer's or, you know, just some chronic illness, and they just seem to be in shock and surprise and have no understanding of how this happened to them. But you actually are going to help give us a roadmap so we can understand it and then make the choices to support our health and well-being.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand, based, I guess it's my opinion, but I think it's based on a lot of good information and maybe just common sense, everything has a cause. We have a certain category in healthcare called iatrogenic disease where it just happened. We don't know why, and so it has no cause. And it's assumed that because we don't know why, then it really has no cause. It just kind of like happens spontaneously. But just because we don't know is more a reflection of our ignorance rather than what the situation actually is. So everything has a cause. And cancer, any other ailment that you could think of. So the question is, what is causing it? Traditionally, we've tended, both medicine and I think in the public, tend to look at causes in a very isolated model. You had a poor diet. You were exposed to toxins. You didn't exercise enough. You have too much stress. Looking at these things individually, and the reason we do that, of course, is that's how researchers tend to do it. That's what we read in the newspapers. That's what the papers are. They look at these things individually. It's a very artificial designation, and one of the main reasons that they look at these causes individually is because it's the only way they can get their papers published. The model to get a paper published in a journal, a reputable journal, what they call single intervention. In other words, their attitude is the only way to know for sure what the cause was is to look at causes individually. So let's say a researcher wants to take a look at cancer in relationship to psychological stress, poor diet, and lack of exercise. Won't get the study published because the journal will say, well, how do you know which one caused it? Now, in our world, we'd say, does it really matter? It's an additive effect, which I'm going to be talking about. And, of course, that's the ancient model. These things all come together. The journals say, no, we're not going to publish it. So we get into this kind of very artificial designation that's really set up by the model that's used to get research published. So that's number one. These causes all work together. It's additive. But the other area where we tend to segment in terms of our illnesses, particularly when it comes to biochemical imbalances. Your blood sugar is too high. Your cholesterol is too high. Your vitamin D is too low. We tend to look at these things as individual, very isolated biochemical entities. And systems thinking says, while that's the way we learn it, that's not the way it is. That there's an interrelationship between all of these. So let's talk about causes first. They tend to be, like I said, additive. They add together. And therefore, we can no longer think of, well, that's just a minor stressor. I don't exercise, but how could lack of exercise possibly be a cause of my problem? Maybe alone it's not. But when you add it up to all the other stressors, psychological stress, not sleeping, poor diet, then it has significance. So with that in mind, let me get back to what I'm talking about specifically. What is systems thinking? As I mentioned, nothing new in healthcare. It started thousands of years ago. But the term really started being discussed in business, in the business world, looking economic standpoint. And I'll give you an example that I heard. You might remember a few months ago, there was some unrest, the civil unrest, riots in Baltimore, and a baseball game was canceled because of the civil unrest. And the kind of the knee-jerk thinking, big deal. A bunch of million-dollar baseball players are not going to get paid for a day. Who cares? But when you look at it, there was a ripple effect. Well, yes, the baseball players aren't playing, but also the person who's selling the popcorn is not going to work that day. The person who parks the cars is not going to work that day. And they're not going to get any income. And in turn, they can't go to the grocery store and buy food. And so the grocer is not going to make money. So we have this ripple effect just from one game being canceled. There's an interrelationship that they're looking at in economics, that how do these recessions occur that we've been seeing the last few years? It's this ripple effect. That's what the systems thinking is. Research papers have now been published to look at healthcare in the same way. There is a relationship between your high cholesterol and your blood sugar and the fact that you might run a blood test and your vitamin D is too low and one of your inflammatory mediators, the C-reactive protein, is too high. Traditional medical thinking is they're completely isolated. In fact, they are totally interrelated. The term allostasis, allostatic load, comes from the idea that, let's take allostasis first. We've all heard of what is known as the stress response. And I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about that relates to cortisol, stress hormones, and primarily relates to psychological stress. I'm under a lot of stress. Life is difficult at work, my kids, my husband, my wife, whatever it is, psychological stress. In fact, there are many, many different types of stressors. One of them, which we tend to talk about, is psychological stress. But there's stress from too much exercise, too little exercise. Poor diet, which could be lack of certain nutrients. It could be too much of certain nutrients. It could be toxicity. It could be spending too much time in front of the computer. We don't know. Do shortwave electromagnetic waves, radiation, cause cancer? I can't answer that question. There's an elaborate amount of research that says that being exposed to cell phones and being on the computer a lot, it is a stressor to the system. But then there's other stressors that sometimes that we really don't think about because they're not politically correct, they're not popular. For example, thermal stress, we have to start taking a look at that now. Parts of the country are getting much hotter, and where I come from, we had one of the coldest winters we've had in decades. That is a stressor. When you start adding them all up, this is where the impact comes. Now, for the cumulative stress, the body responds to it. I'll give you an example of what I mean by a response to a stressor. Let's say it's a hot summer day, and it's 90 degrees out, and you decide to go swimming. And so you jump in the pool. Let's say the pool is like 70 degrees. Now, you have an instantaneous, a 20-degree change in your environment in a fraction of a second. Why don't we die of thermal shock? Our body temperature was 98.6. We're now in 70-degree water. Why don't we die? Because the body instantaneously responds. And it's a whole body response. It's not just the adrenals that we all hear about. It's a whole body response. And this whole body response is called allostasis. It involves the immune system, all the different organs. It involves the brain and, yes, the adrenals. This body response occurs to basically cope with this change in environmental temperature, if you will. Now, the other key thing about the allostatic response to this stressor is that from a genetic evolutionary point of view, from a short-term standpoint, it's a good thing. It's positive. The body needs to be stressed. It grows. It expands. It repairs. And so what's the net result when we jump in the pool? From a short-term standpoint, Our body responds, and what's the net effect? Ah, I feel good. This is wonderful. It's cooling and refreshing. But what happens if we stay in the water too long? Now the body has to continue to respond to a temperature that's lower than body temperature. As this response goes on, this response, which was very positive and made us healthier, we're not going to feel good, it's comfortable. If it goes on too long, this body's response will actually start creating problems, will start creating illness, start creating inflammation, alter glucose metabolism, alter fat metabolism, alter our cholesterol. And what happens is that we perceive this, and all of a sudden, the perception is, I'm cold. Now, this is allostatic load. It went on too long. We were in the water too long. What would logic say to us if we have a response that's going on too long? The logic would be, well, get out of the pool. Eliminate the stressor. That was good in the short term, but not so good in the long term. So the whole idea of this allostatic load that comes from a stressor is that all too often in our lives with chronic illness, we don't get out of the pool. There are certain things that we are doing, certain things we are eating, things that we are thinking that are basically the body has to respond to. And because we do it for a real long time, the body continues to respond to this and ultimately creates illness. That is called allostatic load.
So when you talk about the allostatic load, it's basically what you're saying is we are overdoing the various sources of stress without mitigating it or being remedial in how we address it, so it starts to take its toll because the body is just, it's like a burden that just has, it's like the weight is increasing on our system.
Exactly.
Let me give you another example.
We all know, let's talk about exercise. We all know, this is a classic example of allostasis, positive, tissue repairing, tissue building, and potentially negative. Let's say we take 20 minutes and we go for a refreshing walk or maybe lift some weights. We do it in a very controlled situation. We've had some instruction. We know what's right for us and what's the net result. The muscle is conditioned. It gets bigger. It gets healthier, generally in the short term. But if we do the exact same thing too long, what was good for us for a mile, we started to decide, well, let's run a marathon. The exact same thing, doing it for 1 mile and 26 miles can have a very different result because it went on too long. How did the body respond to the short-term stressor? It responded by making the muscle stronger, and it made it bigger. But if we continue it, the body it's too much. And now the body will basically progress into a situation where the very thing that was making it healthy, which was the reparative process, which involves inflammation, changes in insulin metabolism, this very process, if it goes on too long with overexercise, actually will start causing muscle damage, start causing more inflammation, start causing pain. Classic example of allostasis, positive stress, and allostatic load. Generally speaking, stress that went on too long. So we tend to just basically take things that may have been good for us in the short term and do them longer than we should.
So what is, in this regard, what is the message that you offer to your clients, to your patients? You know, is it that we have to, first of all, be aware of the things that support us to optimize our health and stay in balance, but also have enough awareness when things are out of balance and then become more dangerous to our health?
Well said. As I tell people very often when I give my seminars, my biochemistry seminars, I'm lecturing for like 8 hours or 6 hours or whatever, I say at the end, I just gave you the biochemistry of grandma's advice, moderation, variety, and common sense. And that's what really the native, we talk about the native populations. That's what they understand, moderation. We tend to be an all or none society, that the opposite of too much is don't do it at all. Just because, you know, I'll hear all the time. I heard that and fill in the blank. I heard too much vitamin D is unhealthy. I heard too much fish oil is unhealthy. I heard too much bad is unhealthy. And where we tend to go is, well, since too much is bad, let's cut it out completely. And the reality is, of course, is that just because too much of something is bad doesn't make the substance inherently bad. And so if we basically, right now, of course, thinking is we eat too much carbohydrate. Well, does it mean that carbohydrate is bad? No, we just took in too much. One area in particular I did want to mention also, where I see most of the problems that people don't quite understand, and this is the issue of thinking. Your thoughts are probably one of the most powerful stressors that exist. There's been a large body of research. You know, we hear about things being causing inflammation, like gluten, for example, foods we're allergic to, being causing inflammation. A thought can be just as pro-inflammatory as gluten. In fact, even more so. And the reason is, of course, when you're eating gluten, how many hours a day can you actually eat? At some point, you get full. The reason that thoughts, and again, it's cumulative, are so pro-inflammatory and cause so much illness is because sometimes during our entire waking hours, and even sometimes in our dreams, we worry. Very powerfully pro-inflammatory, a big contributor to allostatic growth.
So we're coming up to a break, but before we do that, you know, it's the message I hear you saying is, first of all, people have to be responsible for their health. They have to understand that, preferably taking care of themselves all along, so they don't get surprised when some diagnosis occurs, and the signs are there all along before something, you know, where the balance tips and someone actually then gets a, you know, diagnosis as such because the body is so out of balance. We really need to appreciate and understand this whole concept of taking responsibility for our health, learning the resources that we need to actuate into our lives and practice them and really get into a routine that's looking after our bodies and the needs of our bodies.
That's exactly right. As I tell my patients, and I usually get very difficult patients, they've been everywhere, they've tried everything, all the alternative medicine practitioners, and one of the hardest things for them to accept, and I said, if you can accept this, this is your best hope in getting well, is you made yourself sick. There are things that you are doing you're not even aware of, and they act cumulatively to create whatever problem you have. And you can either take that as an, oh, my God, I made myself sick, it's hopeless, or you can take it, since I made myself sick, I can make myself well by changing the way I live my life and looking at all aspects of life. If you can get rid of all the sacred cows, no matter what your problem is, there's hope.
And that's true for every diagnosis, whatever the condition may be that we are experiencing, whatever names we put on that balance that's been affected by that allostatic load, we have influence over and can heal.
Exactly right. Now, that doesn't preclude, of course, medical intervention.
Mm-hmm.
There is when we reach a certain level of imbalance, can we just eliminate the stressors and get back to total health? No, we all reach a point due to the impact of the stress, due to age, other factors that come into play, where we need assistance from others, whether it be alternative medical practices, allopathic, conventional medical practices, standard medicine. There's a place for all of it. It has its place. But I'm not saying this is exclusive. We basically do this instead of something. What I'm saying is take this approach and add it to whatever you are doing. You're going to get a better result.
Exactly, and understand that whatever help you may be needing, whether it's traditional medicine, you still have things that you are responsible for in terms of how you live your life and the choices you make that support your body's ability to heal and recover.
Precisely.
You know, I mean, just really briefly before we take our break, but, you know, I meet so many women who had a breast cancer diagnosis as an example. They went through the traditional treatments, chemo, radiation, maybe mastectomy, and their doctors then sent them on their way without any guidance as to what other changes are required to support their health for their long term.
Very well said. And we talk a lot about this particular model I've been discussing in terms of lifestyle changes, supplementation, as an adjunct. The oncologists do a tremendous job in getting rid of the cancers. And God bless them. I'm glad they're there. And that's their specialty. But very often, what does the cancer patient say? Thank you for getting rid of my cancer, but I still feel terrible. I don't feel good. I don't look good. I can't do the things I want to do. And so by taking this type of model I'm talking about, looking at your life, the things that you do, the things that you don't do, things that you can add to your life, you can use this adjunctively to help basically get to where you want. It's not just cancer-free, but live the life that you want to live. Feel good. Think happy thoughts. go out and enjoy life.
So that's what we're going to talk about when we come back from the break. Dr. Moss was sharing with us the strategies and the understandings, everything from the kinds of supplements or what we need to do when we're under stress and lifestyle factors. He's going to give us some more keys to the kingdom. So stay tuned. You are listening to What Women Must Know. I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman, and my guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Moss. So we have a great show in store. We'll see you back very shortly.
Keep listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Love, lust, and laughter. Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Moss. He has created Moss Nutrition Products for the past 23 years, and he is also an adjunct faculty member at the University of Ridgeport Nutrition Institute. He has a lot of wisdom, a lot of experience, and we're talking about the systems approach, the many factors that create a load on the body that ultimately compromises the body's functioning. So we're going to be exploring in this half of the show what to do, what are the implications of the various stressors in our life, but even more importantly, what are the action steps we need to be taking. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Dr. Moss.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the first thing we have to do is, I mentioned, we have to understand, number one, that it is the cumulative amount of different stressors. They all add up. The body has to respond to these stressors with this allostatic process. And if these stressors go on too long, they aren't eliminated, or there's too much of it, the body will continue to respond. And this very response, which in the short term was creating health, is going to make us sick. With that in mind, where we begin.
I just want to jump in. So can you actually give us a laundry list of what are some of those potential stressors that happen in people's lives?
Yes. I've tried my best to kind of look at what I see most in my patients and in the typical American in general. I've divided them into seven different areas. Number one would be movement. We are beings that need to move. The lack of movement against gravity is a fundamental, it's a nutrient, if you will. They've done some very interesting research on astronauts. And what happens when you eliminate gravity? They get really sick, and not just loss of bone. They get virtually every cell in the body becomes dysfunctional. So movement against gravity is a basic nutrient, if you will. That's number one. Number two, infection. Looking at not only colds and flu, but some of the infections now, chronic infections we're now looking at, which may range from Lyme disease to intestinal parasites, it's become a significant issue. This is a significant stressor. Number three would be toxicology. I'm not talking about now massive exposures. We might see what they call occupational exposures. You work in a toxic waste dump, you're a factory worker in a dental office, you work with mercury. I'm talking about the low-grade exposures we get just from daily living, the low-grade amounts we might get of heavy metals or chemicals that are just part of our environment. They're not going to go anywhere soon. Fourth thing would be diet. And, of course, when people say diet, they tend to think of deficiency, particularly of micronutrients. We have to understand it's a matter of balance, too much or too little. So I look at these days, in many cases, I'm much more concerned about excess. With the fortification of foods of micronutrients, the large amount of supplements that are being ingested, I'm just as wary in the patients I evaluate that they're getting too much of certain nutrients, both micronutrients, vitamin C, vitamin D, B vitamins or whatever, and macronutrients, too much fat, too much carbohydrate, too much protein, et cetera. Next thing I'm going to look at is going to be issues related to what I call a neurologic imbalance, for lack of a better term, but what I'm talking about more precisely, your thoughts. And the most difficult people I've seen, they come to me, the diet is perfect. They've taken every supplement. There's nothing I can suggest they haven't taken. Very often, why aren't they getting better? It's because of thought stress. And the hardest concept I get them to understand, all of these things will cause this response, which primarily revolves around creating inflammation. Thoughts, a negative thought is extremely pro-inflammatory. And again, given the sheer magnitude of the amount of time we spend with negative thinking, makes it particularly powerful and creates a tremendous amount of this total environmental stress. The next thing I look at is electromagnetic stress, particularly are we spending too much time in front of our computers, smartphones, etc. And the last one, as I mentioned before, I've really been looking at just the last year or so, with climate change and how we're, for the last several decades, maybe 100 years or so, in the United States, we've had a moderate climate for the most part. Now we're starting to see extremes. There's a lot of research on temperature stress. What happens when you're exposed to very high temperatures or very low temperatures for a prolonged period of time? It will have this pro-inflammatory allostatic load impact. So what I try to do is just get people to look at all of these. Most people want to focus on one or two. I just want to focus on diet. No, I just want to focus on exercise. No, I just want to focus on infection. No, I just want to focus on toxicology. But I say, if you really want to understand why you're sick, you need to take a look at all of them, even the ones that may be uncomfortable to look at. There's been some very interesting research getting back to this issue of thoughts. There was a researcher named... I think she's still alive. Her name is Shelley Taylor. And she was looking at the stress response in women. And we know the male stress response, fight or flight. We all heard about that. Well, what she discovered was most of the research on fight or flight was done on men. With men, from an evolutionary point of view, it makes sense. When there is a challenge in the tribe, you go out and kill, you need food, you go out and kill the animal and slay the enemy. You go out, you leave the community. Well, if women did the same thing, the first thought with stress is to leave the babies, we wouldn't be here. So what Taylor pointed out was that when women are under stress, they tend to do what she called tend and befriend, gather, come together, communicate, relate. And so her point being is that, and certainly loneliness is an issue for men, but particularly when women are lonely, when they don't have someone they can talk to, relate to, that's particularly pro-inflammatory in women. It does happen in men, but much more so in women. So very often I'll see, have patients, they live alone. Their husbands have died, they're on disability, and try to convey to them, this is a powerful pro-inflammatory stressor that you need to address in addition to the diet and the exercise and the toxins, looking at all of them together. Let's take them one at a time, these seven key areas. Let's identify where it is and do the best that you can to bring things into moderation. I'm not saying never think again, but what I am saying is instead of worrying your entire waking time, why don't we introduce some pleasure? Get together with a friend. Take a class in yoga. Meditate. One of my favorites, listen to music. Not as background, not multitask, but I mean sit down for an hour and put on the headphones and put on your favorite music. Very powerfully anti-inflammatory. That's where I start. Basically looking at this total, all of these things that came together create this total cumulative load effect, stress load effect. Let's break them down and bring them down to moderation as best as we can. That very often will do have a major impact in helping people feel better no matter what their chief complaint is, what their symptom. I'm not saying we're going to cure cancer with this, but in terms of the quality of life issues, I'm tired, I don't feel good, I'm achy, I can't do the things I want to do. This type of approach towards all the life stressors can have a tremendous impact. To the extent that it doesn't resolve all the issues, and very often it doesn't, then we start looking at these individual metabolic imbalances that were created by this total load. Why is the cholesterol elevated? Why am I inflamed? My blood sugar isn't quite where it needs to be. To that extent, we start looking at interventions such as supplements. Maybe pharmaceuticals are needed. Medical intervention is needed. But we're doing this as a complement to our addressing our environmental stressors, not instead. When you combine what we used to do purely with supplements or drugs or whatever, without addressing environmental stressors, you may have gotten some result, but when you address the environmental stressors along with these interventions, you're going to get better results. That's the model.
So I have a question I wanted to ask you. When you were talking about the need to find balance and you were concerned that some people overdo their vitamins and supplements, can you just comment on that? Comment about what are some of the risks when people take like tons of supplements. I have people who are on 15, 20 different supplements. Everything going that sounds good, they're on. What's the story about that?
Sure. There is a fundamentally flawed premise, largely based on marketing. The industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry, after all. The idea that in supplements can either I'm talking about nutrients now. I'm not talking about herbs. I'm talking about nutrients, mainly vitamins and minerals. That they can cure disease. Anybody can take them in any amount, and you're going to either cure disease or you're going to prevent disease. The insurance policy. I can take these supplements, and it'll allow me to do whatever I want. Well, this is more good marketing than good science. The science is actually almost like common sense. We know these nutrients, they're essential nutrients. We've got to have them. What do supplements do? And there's been several papers written on this. It's actually quite simple. What they do, they replete deficiencies. If you're not taking in enough, and enough, how would we find it? What is enough? Well, it's not just the traditional RDA, what enough you need to stay alive. We tend to need more of that given the lifestyle choices that we make in our society, some of which we can't do anything about. The toxins aren't going away anytime soon. We can try to live below the glass bubble, but the fact remains it's a toxic world. Because of those toxins, we need more nutrients. So we need more than the RDA. And to the extent that we take nutrients to replete the deficiency, we'll feel better. But once you replete a deficiency, for the most part, the nutrients do absolutely nothing. at least nothing good. Generally speaking, if you keep on taking more than what you need, you'll start getting sick, just like anything else in our world. This is not just true of nutrients. It's true of everything. Water. Water is an essential nutrient. We all know that. But if you take in too much, you're going to get real sick. In fact, one of the probably the nutrient that has the highest mortality rate in the history of the world is water, when you think about it, commonly known as drowning. But just because too much water will kill you doesn't mean we stop drinking water. The micronutrients are the same way. To the extent you're deficient, you should get them either through supplements or diet. But once you're repleted, generally nothing good is going to happen. Just like when you drink more water than you need, generally speaking, nothing good is going to happen.
So does that mean people need to get tested to assess what their nutrient levels are?
I'm a big advocate. Yeah, I'm a big advocate. Certainly there's a place, if you feel good and you're doing well and you want to take a multi, go for it. Probably no real harm in that. You can do a little research on your own. But if you don't feel good, and most of us have our issues, who among us is not a patient? We all have our issues. It may be not enough to inhibit us, our lifestyle, but we all have our little aches and pains and things we can't do. If we want to use nutrients to help us feel better, deal with something, an issue that we have, I'm a very strong advocate that you should get counseling, consult with a knowledgeable healthcare professional who's knowledgeable in nutrition. Certainly there are MDs out there, chiropractors, nutritionists, naturopaths, many who have an education in nutrition in a field, as opposed to just trying to experiment with nutrients to help you feel better. I think it's the best way to go is to be assessed by a knowledgeable practitioner. I feel very strongly about that.
So I wanted to ask you another question. When you were giving your webinar, you were talking about the impact of stress, particularly related to the role of what was known as C-reactive protein and how we use up protein under stress. And I want you to talk about that, because I get some concern when people are focusing on more of a vegetarian, vegan diet, a raw diet, may not be getting adequate protein. I don't think people really understand how important it is to have adequate levels of protein, however they get it, because of its role with stress. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure.
You did such a good job on that webinar.
Thank you. This is an extremely important point. The body, when it's under stress, and again, I'm using stress, not just thought stress, exercise stress, too much exercise, poor diet, whatever it is, and how they all add up together, the body has to make a decision constantly, what is it going to do with the protein it has? It primarily is going to go in two directions. Number one, it's going to, what we call, the term is anabolic, build tissue, build muscle, build gut lining, repair tissues, or repair the body. And, of course, it's not all or none, but when there's proper balance, some of it is going to go to build these tissues that we need to do things, and some of the protein is going to go to build things that promote inflammation. Almost all the things in the body, these what they call inflammatory mediators, are made out of protein. Most famous one, as you mentioned, is C-reactive protein. And with health, there's a good balance between the two. But when we overdo it, too much of these cumulative stressors, the body is going to decide, I have to make a decision right now. Where am I going to put the protein? Where am I going to put it? Number one, I can keep on building muscle and gut lining, or I can build inflammatory mediators. When you're under this allostatic load, this over too much stress, too much life stress, all of it, the body will preferentially go to building inflammatory mediators, C-reactive protein. What is the body saying? The model I use is the caveman, the saber-toothed tiger. The body is saying, I'm in trouble. I have this threat going on. I'm under stress. And so I have to basically protect myself. And how does the body protect itself? It makes these inflammatory mediators like C-reactive protein. Now, the body's thinking, well, you know, the stress will just last for a short period of time, because we come from basically the caveman. And the caveman, the stress was always short term. Think about it a minute. Caveman saw the saber-toothed tiger. He or she either escaped really quick, or he was eaten. Either way, it only lasts a short period of time. Caveman got an infection. Either got well real quick, or he died. Either way, the stress was short term. The body was only the body understands short term stress. What happens when it goes on long term? Let's go back to the short term issue. The body says, "All right, I need some more C-reactive protein, so I'm going to take some protein away from my muscles and away from my gut lining, and let's make more C-reactive protein, and as soon as I escape the saber-toothed tiger, I'll go back to balance." But, of course, in our world, we never escape our saber-toothed tigers, particularly the saber-toothed tigers that we think about in our mind. And thinking about a saber-toothed tiger, our body responds exactly the same as there actually was the saber-toothed tiger. And so, because of this cumulative load, and the body has to make its decision, the body will start tending to rob the muscles and the gut lining and other tissues to make more of the C-reactive protein, and we start getting sick. Therefore, if we want to build things back up, we're going to need additional protein. And most of us, because we are all patients, we all have our issues, we need more than what a healthy person needs. There is a classic textbook dietetics approach of what a healthy person needs. Problem is most of us, we're not healthy, not 100%. And because the body is now using the protein to make more of this C-reactive protein, there's not enough left for all the other stuff, and you need to eat more. Generally speaking, for many patients who have significant health issues, it's almost impossible to get enough from your diet. And the main reason is you just get full. Protein's filling. And so for people who are ailing, the amount that is needed to cope with this, the fact that the protein is now making more of the C-reactive protein to help build up the other organs, we need to get amounts that will have to be met with both diet and supplement.
So is there a guideline as to how much protein or what's the most efficient form of protein? What do you recommend to your patients?
Yeah. There is a formula. Do you mind if I talk a formula? It's not that complicated. Should I
sure.
talk about the formula? Okay. The formula is for a healthy, the quote-unquote, the healthy person. Standard textbook is what they call 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight. So to translate that into ordinary numbers, let's say you're a 150-pound individual, which is the standard that you use in healthcare. If you're 150 pounds, you would need probably about two to three ounces of protein a day. However, most of us are not healthy. We all have problems. We're all inflamed. We're all exposed to the same toxins. We're all probably worried too much. We're not getting enough exercise. We're getting too much exercise, we're dealing with infections, all the things of daily living. We get caught in traffic, all these things we deal with. Sometimes we get lonely. We spend too much time on our computers. We all do it. So we're going to need more. Research says you need about 50% more than this quote-unquote healthy person. So instead of the 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight, you need about 1.2 to 1.5 grams. So you can do these calculations. That would translate out to about maybe 4, sometimes 5 ounces of quality protein a day. Again, difficult to do from diet, with quality food, that is. Not just talking about getting a junk food. And even if you could do it with diet, again, the research has shown most people have trouble eating that much protein because they just get full. You get bloated. And so we rely on supplements. In terms of the supplementation, generally relying on protein powders. Most of the protein powder, that's the most well-researched protein powder is whey protein. It's what they call the most anabolic, which means tissue repairing. All those tissues that broke down, the muscles, the gut lining, to make the C-reactive protein, the whey protein will be very helpful in building those tissues, particularly muscle tissue. The challenge, of course, with whey protein is a concern about allergenicity. Dairy products, sometimes digestibility. And so a alternative form, which is really rising up rapidly in terms of popularity and good research, is pea protein.
Hmm.
It appears to have the similar amino acid profile of what they call anabolic tissue-building amino acids as whey protein. And it's looked very good. Not as much research, but it's performing quite well. There are certainly other proteins on the market, but right now we tend to lean towards the whey or the pea protein. Soy protein used to be popular, but we're moving away from that. It tends to be there's a lot of allergenicity with it. We're concerned about GMO with soy protein. And also, soy contains what are known as goitrogen, things that will suppress thyroid function. So that's a concern. Rice protein used to be very popular, but one of the problems is rice is, as we know, grown in rice paddies. And we're seeing a worldwide problem in rice seems to preferentially uptake arsenic.
Yes.
And it's almost impossible right now to find rice protein. I emphasize rice protein. I'm not saying never eat rice again. I'm not saying don't go to your local Japanese restaurant, never eat the rice. That's not what I'm talking about. You're not going to get, again, it's a matter of balance. Please keep that in mind. Too much is a bad thing. But the idea of never eat rice again, that's not what I'm talking about. What's
so
the problem
it's,
with rice protein? It's concentrated.
It's whey and pea protein, and we're coming to the end of the show, so I just want to ask you this one really important question.
Sure.
Should people have protein at every meal? Do you think that is appropriate, or if they can just get their allotted protein requirements with one meal?
Sure. There's a difference in research on this in terms of what is going to be the most beneficial from a tissue repair standpoint. Most of the research actually suggests to get the best impact in terms of building muscle, for example, is actually at one meal. Get the best impact, particularly if you can do it around the time that you do your weight-bearing exercise. From a practical standpoint, that's a lot of protein. You just can't eat that much. And so from a practical standpoint, usually you want a little at every meal. But really, it tends to be individual, whatever works best for you. The point is you need to get the right amount of protein, and whatever works best for you is right.
Okay. Well, Dr. Moss, we need to go. This has been so fascinating. We've taken you right to the end of the show. Thank you so much for being with us today. And
thank
to all
so
of my listeners, thank you. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. We really appreciated you sharing your journey with us today. And until next time, always remember the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.